Well,
we were talking about movies and communication and so forth the last time we were at this hour. And we do have some movies in camp. They are not in aid of necessarily any educational program. I don't believe in planning ahead or anything like that. They are just what we could get, a little bit of money we had, and what was available from the various companies. I hope you saw that little movie last night, or you will this afternoon, just for the fun of it, Peter Ustinov, because he seems like a very wholesome person. I think you'll enjoy it. It's about a man who treated people like a dog, and so he's turned into a dog. He has to look at life from a dog's point of view. It's kind of cute, kind of interesting. I think it's 3 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken.
How long is it?
It's about an hour and a half. And it's really cool. The man who wagged his tail, I think when it was out in Italian and Spanish, it was called Angel Without a Passport. It's about 15 or 20 years old, something like 15 years old, something like that. It's kind of interesting. And we did have the Cabinet of Dr. Cagliari around here, which is a very interesting film. Did any of you get to see that? Maybe some of the longer-term people did. Did you ever go over and see? We showed that to the Narnia kids, and they enjoyed it, too. It was the first surrealistic film ever made. In other words, the sets and everything are obviously artificial. It looks a little bit like Munchkin Land, you know, or something like that. But they were done by Dali and all of these famous painters. They just invited them to come out to the studio, you know, and just go wild. And then it's a story about some murders that took place in Hamburg. This is in 1919, and in which a guy confessed to the murders who it turned out hadn't done the murders, and it turned out it was a very high prominent official who had really done the murders, you know, and they never did get him and all that kind of business. These guys were upset, you know, about this status of society in Germany at that time, so they made an allegory on that, and Cagliari is this kind of witch doctor, root doctor type, going around with a sort of a Frankenstein type monster, entertaining people in sideshows and then knocking people off for no apparent reason. I mean, he's not making any money or anything out of it, he's just knocking them off at night, murder scare. And then when a guy gets interested in it, because his friend is one of them that gets bumped off, he checks and finds out that Cagliari is the chief psychiatrist in charge of the state mental hospital. And this monster he's got is one of the patients. And, you know, it runs through that thing, and finally, you know, they track him down and throw him in a straitjacket. And that's the way the movie was made. That's the way the script was written by a young left-wing veteran of the First World War. But when they showed the movie the first time, the state authorities clamped down on them and made them produce about 10 more minutes of film and tack on to the end, which is why the film is a little bit confusing. Of course, the kids enjoy it, and we just enjoy it because it's camp. It's just high, stupid, funny comedy for us now. But they made them produce this little epilogue in which you have scenes in a mental hospital, and here is the guy who tracks down the murderer and everything standing around, and there's all the people who were killed, you know, playing with their belly button and putting their finger in their ear and acting like Napoleon and everything. And then Cagliari comes through well-dressed and kindly. He obviously is the psychiatrist and is a really nice guy. Because their allegory was that, you know, the real extreme madness, the really terrible thing in life, is not that you have murderers and murders every once in a while, but that the murderers, the insane people, are in control of the institutions of the state. And that's what he was saying about Germany, which was not really so far from the truth, I suppose. And they wanted it made perfectly clear that this was just a ranting of a madman. So the movie has some historical warrant. When Hitler came to power, they seized all the copies of the film. And in fact, the copy which we rented is still copyright Attorney General of the United States. It's part of the booty in 1945. It's got another Nazi archive. So that there's something to everything. It's not just an hour-long, you know, silly comedy or classical film or something like that. Movies are like that. Because film, as every form of communication or art, attempts to do something. We talked earlier this morning, some of you probably were here between 8:15 and 10 o'clock. How many were here? So I don't know, not too many, but some. We were talking about what is the essence of communication. Of course, we talk about it all the time. I just wrote a little silly poem about it, which hasn't been typed up yet. When it is, I'll pass it to you and you'll see my cynical thoughts on it. But the more we talk about communication, particularly in a place like this or any place that does it a lot, the less communication takes place. Because our communication is like unto a boat that can receive messages from the shore but can't transmit them back. We sit and, you know, we are screened to with slides and movies and records are played and we are sung to and preached to and scripture read to. And we sit there and maybe say amen or something like that. But communication means not only can I have reception from the Coast Guard station on shore, but when I'm in trouble or when I want to say something, I can talk back. There is no communication unless it's two-way. And film, at its best, is one of the better means of communication. This may seem a silly thing to say because it's obviously prepared ahead of time. It's been made a year or 2 years before you see it, you know, and it's set and you sit there. But if you think about Marshall McLuhan and his phenomenology or philosophy of communication, which is the basis of his thing, it is an involving medium. And particularly this is true of things like Cagliari, which is a kind of a surrealistic thing, and the Bergman films and the films today, we say they don't have any plot, they don't make any sense, you know, and all that. You have to come to it yourself with your own experience and as the word talked back to it, or you don't get anything out of it. You can just sit there on your can, you know, and get corns on your cornless places while the good guys beat the bad guys, you know, over and over and over again. There's no communication of that. In fact, it's bullshit, if you'll pardon a good theological term, because the good guys don't ever beat the bad guys, as far as I know, in history. But if you get up there and it's kind of dubious as to what is going on and what has happened, then you can get involved with it. And it is a part of communication to say, you know, this doesn't really speak to me. It doesn't say anything. At least some communication is taking place. A lot better than just getting a little packet cast over into your mind or your left and you think, you know, you've been communicated with. Communication has nothing to do with content. It has to do with transmission. It has to do with interpersonal interaction. And the better... you can't even say that. The only communicators are the ones who invite us in and involve us, sometimes against our will. That's the reason it can be entertaining. We don't know what's happening in this kind of interchange and interaction. I don't think the little movie that I hope you'll see, because we paid money to put it out here, and it's not for your good at all. In fact, I would be cynical enough to say the more I was concerned for your soul and your good, the less I'll ever be able to communicate with you. But this little movie about the puppy dog, you know, and so forth, really doesn't communicate very much. It is highly entertaining, but it's so moralistic. You know, you act like a dog, you turn into a dog. And the old Italian fairy that lays the spell on the guy says, you'll stay like that until you can get somebody to love you, which I seriously doubt will ever happen. And just in a backward sort of a one-handed way, a little boy does love the dog, and that's enough to break the spell. Fact is, people who get to be 40 years old and unloving and acting like dogs usually don't change, not even little kids, for instance. It's best, you know, really to face up to that instead of going through the world with a pie-eyed vision of what reality is like. So that's not really a communicative film in that sense. There's some, though, others, that do communicate with us because they invite us in and to argue back, as it were. There's not much difference when you get down to just proclamation, sermonizing, telling you whether it's, you know, to make you enjoy the good guys chasing the bad guys, or to, you know, improve your soul or whatever is involved. There's no difference between that and just sheer brainwashing and propaganda. And it does as much spiritually for you as brainwashing does for you. So we have to be challenged in a way, even if the ideas are wrong or we don't come out any place, to have experience, not communication, but what communication is possible only in the presence of and what it exists for, and that is to produce community. They say that marriage counselors are able to tell when a marriage is in trouble when the husband and wife no longer talk to each other or about anything significant. That's just trite. It's just absolutely true. And friends, business partners, associates, colleagues, and whatever enterprise you're in, you know, if they don't talk to each other, you can be certain that everything is screwed up. So the answer is not communication. You know, we always love to grab hold of a tag end or a nice red flag or something and wave it. The answer is producing community. And it's like chicken, egg. If there's the community, you've got communication. And if you can get communication, you've got community, at least incipiently. So there's no easy way to do it. But entertaining or staying at the level of the common denominator, what everybody feels is right, you know, at the level of piety and patriotism, if you will, of morality and the usual thing, is the safest way of preventing any communication and community from happening. Because communication will involve conflict and struggle and oppositional ideas and this sort of thing. It almost has to. So I suppose, and I'm talking through my hat here because I have not had the time, it just comes down to that, to see the new Kubrick film. I had thought about trying to take a day off and drive to Detroit, which is the closest place it was playing to me before I got away on vacation. I just don't have that kind of time in my schedule, being as much a prisoner as anybody else. But from what I understand about the new Kubrick film, Clockwork Orange, that we scattergunned at the other day, it precisely sort of makes this point. Doing something for people's good, you know. After all, an operation on the mind, a sort of a lobotomy, is a communication in the old-fashioned sense of doing something for your good. You don't really get the person's approval for it. I'm going to do it for you. Just like I'm going to tell you about Jesus Christ right now, brother. I don't give a goddamn whether you want to get it or not, but you're going to, you know, hear it. I'm going to give you a tract and put a Bible in your hotel room so when you're looking for cigarettes tonight, you'll find that Bible. You know? Maybe when the girl gets up to go home, you know, you'll trip over the Gideon Testament or something like that. I'm going to really lay it on you, you know. I'm going to cut your cerebral cortex in various places and fix you so you no longer have these hostile thoughts and so forth. But what Kubrick, you know, with his masterful, honest, open cynicism about humanity does is show, you know, when you cut one of those things, you maybe cut the reason the guy was a great leader in the other. You can't take the good. Yeah.
You are on the second floor. Will you please pull up that door so the fireplace doesn't smoke?
Cold, okay.
And the other one here also. Thank you.
Excuse me. Oh, that was a useful communication. And you notice she did something, too. That's another problem called authority.
Respect.
Authority. But I think it's really illustrative of another thing, too. It made sense. You know, it was a useful thing. None of us wants to get smoked out in here. Maybe the reason we say nobody ever does any of the things I tell them to do, or, you know, nobody really is improved much by my preaching or my communication, this maybe what we say doesn't make any sense. Maybe what we're telling them doesn't make any sense. William James and John Dewey both, you know, while I don't think of them as God, they were very intelligent men. They applied their minds to human things. And they would say, you know, if the thing that you're laying down is in no wise any different from something else, well, it really isn't any different. Why can you get stirred up to do anything? It really doesn't amount to anything. And, of course, we're familiar with the usual criticism of us as just being good Germans. are good citizens, you know. And Christianity, essentially, doesn't look that much different in most of its forms. Only today, we're to have, which I don't think is much of a change from being a good German, we're going to have strength through joy along with, you know, being good citizens. We're Immanuel Kant plus Adolf Hitler is what it amounts to. When you add the joyful, you know, sensual element, you have to remember somebody else who was a bigger master at brainwashing than we are added that element a long time ago. That's the reason we have the Volkswagen. Think about it. It doesn't pay to be German descended. You go around with guilt feelings all the time. So communication is a two-way kind of thing. A lot of times, too, and this is where I left the discussion of a few out-of-date movies, because you've seen these movies or you could have seen these movies a few years ago. What the general viewer and even commentator, particularly religious commentator, has to say about the movies, it just doesn't obtain. It misses the point completely. It's like I've sat through a trial one time with someone and the guy was found guiltless. And there were some people there that were convinced he was found guilty. They were just not really capable of understanding the nuances of what was going on. And we were talking about some of the scientific movies of late. How many of you have seen or been exposed to something about the 2001 business? You know, the Space Odyssey. It's made quite an impact upon Western culture. You know, I think deservedly so. It's an interesting experience. Although I would gladly trade back the hours. I've seen it about 27 times now because we've used it in classes and that sort of thing for it, but it was interesting. Then how about Andromeda Strain, which was out not long ago? And there was another one, Omega Man. Yeah, you've seen them all. You know. Most people, you know, look at those things and draw the absolutely wrong conclusion about them. Particularly when you get down to Andromeda Strain, which was fascinating. It's got to be fascinating to any little boy, and that means any man at least. They showed you, you know, this fail-safe, foolproof scientific system, you know, by which they were going to keep this thing pure and so forth. Really fascinating, the technological devices, and undoubtedly they must be based on fact, the way such things are done. In fact, the whole movie seemed to be given over to a kind of a documentary on if you had this absolutely impossible kind of a problem to deal with, what technological, you know, and mechanical steps would you take to deal with it? That's what it's about. So it looks like a super science movie. And actually, it is an anti-science tirade, if you look at it very closely. And so anti-technological and scientific and anti-scientific that it goes beyond the bounds that I would think of balance, because while we need to be critical of these things, certainly anybody that wants to go back to the nomad culture, I think, really needs his head examined. Needs to really think about it a little bit. Okay, this is where I'd gotten to in this little passage. For strictly political films, as well as films of a philosophical nature, America largely depends on European efforts. And two very good ones coming from the same director are Z and The Confession. Did any of you see those? Z. How about The Confession? The one is about a left-wing martyr to the right-wing side in Greece, and The Confession is about not a right-wing necessarily, but a kind of a middle-of-the-road martyr to the left-wing zeal, so he balances them all. You really should see Z. It's just Z, you know, Z. You really should see that. It's something else. It's well-made as well as being a good little picture of Greece today. When political comment is made in the average American film, it's done oftentimes about the past era, as in the recent movie Fool's Parade. That's about the 30s. Have any of you seen that? We can deal with that. You know, this is on the same vein as making the observation that while we have lots of war movies today, we have almost none on Vietnam. In fact, there's only been one made on Vietnam in America, and that one was foolish. But we can deal with these kinds of things, you know, in past time. The films of the last few years either have avoided social and political issues or else dealt with them in a way that uses them only as a springboard in the fantasy that can threaten no one. Now, I would say that Easy Rider fits in here. Some of you have seen Easy Rider. You know, it so obviously uses situations which are real. There are places where you dasn't ride through on a Honda, you know, or hitchhike through. And I can tell you about investigating that counterculture, that's certainly true. And they aren't all below the Mason-Dixon line by any means. But the fact that two hippie-looking type young men would get gunned down going through Alabama is far from being unreal. In fact, it's just a reporting of what's happened a number of times. But it's so unreal in its whole way, setting out to discover America and the way they went about it, that it just loses any punch. It's not, can't be convincing to you unless maybe you're doped up to your eyebrows, you know, and you can't hear because you've been riding your Honda too long or something like that. This is a shame because other than that, you know, it's beautifully made and acted picture and a lot of things. An example of this is also Andromeda Strain. This exciting movie deals with the dangers to the population of the continuation of research into germ warfare. However, it does so in such a roundabout way that it's doubtful whether the viewer finally understands. How many of you saw the movie now? You two, I can see. Anybody else? Three. Four. Sorry, more of you hadn't seen it.
But reading the book?
Well, read the book too, yeah. Okay. It's available. I don't know if it's in a library or not, but like most of the modern movies, it's also a paperback. But if you saw the movie, you remember that the idea that seems to come across is that this germ has come from space. But that's not true if you listen to the dialogue and you look at it the second time. That's not where it came from at all. And in fact, the whole thing hinges around this, which gets obscured. Sometimes you wonder if it got kind of censored at the end when they were making it. There is this Andromeda strain, in other words, this galloping, galoozits, terrible disease, and you get the impression, and at first no one really realized where it came from, that it's come from outer space. Such is not the case. The destructive virus threatening life on Earth is really the result of unrestrained military research in germ warfare. The capsule that lands in a small desert community and starts this epidemic on the face of the Earth wasn't sent back from some other planet, or it didn't go out in the atmosphere of another planet and pick up a virus there, but it was in fact a kind of an in-place bomb, you know, with germs in it, which fell out of orbit and landed, you know, where it shouldn't have and started this thing which almost wiped out the Earth. It says that. In fact, this is the reason for the conflict among the scientists in the latter part of the film. But it's very obscured. Very, very much obscured.
It's overpowered by all that computer.
Right.
That's
what I said. It comes off, you know, if you just think about it superficially, sort of super science. Science got us out of that one, you know. It's like a lot of other recent novels that have been turned off, really, sort of like cranked out. You fail to think about it. Science got us into it in the first place. I really don't have much commendation coming if I pull you out of the fire, if I threw you in there in the first place. But that's exactly what's involved, and if you go back and look at the movie again with this clue in mind, you will see that it's there, although it is very, very obscured. It's, you know, sort of kept down. People aren't as interested in that as they are in the hardware anyhow, too. Again, an issue which exercises many intelligent people, and they are, you know, and have been for a number of years, criticisms and so forth of bacterial warfare and germ warfare and other things of this nature, is used as a springboard for a film just to get it started, and then it rides the back of people's interest in scientific technology. And then you've got all of this technological business that I was telling you about. Plus the fact that it almost couldn't lose at the box office because it was riding on top of several moon flights and so forth. You know, it makes that kind of thing somewhat interesting. So, now, the same thing is true in Space Odyssey. Space Odyssey is at least three movies, as you know. Has more than four people seen 2001 Space Odyssey? Let's see again the hand. So, yeah, I'm not talking in a complete vacuum.
A lot of hands here, thank you.
Yeah, it's at least two or three movies in one, you know, joined together. But the side of it that keeps pulling people back to it, well, it depends on what kind of people you're talking about. The side that pulled most students back over and over again was the space trip. You know, they could go in there stoned and then just sit and groove on those lights. But, you know, apart from that part of the culture, that's very real, you know. Like, see it seven or eight times, you know, going out in the alley in between showings and so forth. Apart from that part of our culture, which is a very real part, it was a technological expertise. I mean, you know, when this gal comes walking out, you know, and she's just balancing in zero gravity, you know, this is really beautiful. And the guy's pin floats away and she plucks it out of the air. And when she goes into the other limb of the module, you know, and she starts walking and walks right up on the ceiling. Well, now, the first time I saw that, you know, boy, oh boy, my heart was pitter-pattering. You know, that was the best thing since the days of the air rifle, really. Anybody that doesn't have a respect and a feeling for technology and machinery, I don't really know where they come from. In our culture, it really blows you away, and that's really how it's developed. If you read the little book, The Making of 2001, they will tell you exactly how they developed these effects. They're really fantastic. Just as big a project in its way is the moon flight in itself. Building up consoles and actual life-size modular limbs and so forth, and working videos and so forth. Even that pin, do you remember that when the pin floats away from the sleeping scientist and so forth? How they carefully stage that with an invisible thread. And they had to take it over and over again until they got it just right. She got it and broke the thread, you know, and got it back in there. Plus the fact that Kubrick, again, with his interest in deep scientific and human issues, he deals with the question of behavioral science, the B.F. Skinner, a behavior modification approach in Clockwork Orange. He's dealing with the whole problem of how we respond to this technology of space in 2001. Didn't put anything in there that's fantastic. In fact, many of the things that seem most fantastic already exist, you know, in prototype models and in government laboratories or private research and so forth. And the rest of it is based on a very kosher scientific predictability as to what undoubtedly is going to develop in the future. So that this is a fantastic education itself. Well, this gets us. But yet, and here's the only point I want to make at this, is 10 million points you could make out of 2001, communicative-wise. Here is a movie that ostensibly is about man. It starts off in the primal swine, with little chimpanzees, so forth. It shows what is undoubtedly the real connection between tool-making and the technological development of culture culminating in the space flight. And it's about man all the way through. And yet we look at that thing for 2.5 hours, and the biggest thing that we carry away from it is this, you know, scientific fantasy. Not fantasy, but how shall I put it? Smorgasbord. This fantastic, rich thing. This is what gets it. And yet right in the middle of it is the time bomb that communicates, and I want to ask you a question on that because I'm not communicating with you, I'm just preaching. There is HAL 3000. How many of you know who HAL 3000 is? He is the computer brain of this rocket. And he not only is a computer such as we have now that, you know, direct our airplane flights and submarine flights and so forth, but he also has like a mechanical personality. He talks and he plays cards, or rather chess and stuff like this with the men in the rocket and so forth. And he is infallible. He repeats over and over again one of the things that is communicated to us by one brand of communicators, you know, never in the history of the 3000 series of the HAL computers has there been a mistake. You know? And then in the capsule, just because of certain kinds of little complications, the human beings begin to suspect that Hal is absolutely in error. He's wrong. And that's another part of the communication. You know, read Saturday Review this month and you'll get science never makes a mistake. Read it next month and you'll find science is, you know, demonic and leading us into danger. And here's Hal 3000. I really don't know, boys, you know, about this. I've never made a mistake, and I show that that component is malfunctioning, you know, and they get out and look at it, and it's not. Well, what nobody suspects, and the heart of the whole thing is, that HAL 3000 is lying. The essence of the whole thing. He hasn't made a mistake. His components have not failed. His logic units have not failed to be logical. The little part of the ship that he declared to be defective that they found was really effective, it wasn't the point. He lied to them. And then he cunningly outwits them and he kills them. It is a movie about man in which not only on the surface but after two or three viewings you still carry away this fantastic business of what science has achieved, but it is a movie in which the tragic hero is a computer. It has something to say. It kind of communicates to me. I wonder about myself. Because the first reaction I got when I got thinking about this is, on the spaceship, by the way, there are about five or six people who are in suspended animation. And there are two who are awake and operating the ship, along with Hal. I got the feeling that there was only one human being on board the Jupiter-bound spaceship. And it is an odyssey telling us about man's journey and where he's going. And that the only human being on that spaceship was, who was it? You saw it. What do you think about 2001? Comment on that. Computer comes off as a human being because, to say a little bit about the two men who are on there, they're perfect examples of what we would call the astronaut, the kind of men that are down in Florida, you know, and so forth. The thing that comes off about them is that they're absolutely wholesome, absolutely in superb physical and mental and spiritual shape, you know. But they have about the consistency and the human interest of buttermilk. They really are homogenized human beings, you know, with they react. I mean, we have to train ourselves in this way, but, you know, you're sitting on the end of this thing and it burns up and you just sit there. The thing burns up under you. These guys are really astronaut types, super trained, super, you know, ready. And they don't lie and they don't smoke. And they don't drink and they don't miss women and they don't steal. And they really don't do a whole hell of a lot when you get right down to it, but what they are programmed to do. And they're really indifferent to human values. One of them has his birthday, and his parents pay a lot of money, you know, to send a video thing out to him, you know, happy birthday, and he's just lying there taking in the sun, yeah, you know, it could be, you know, chimpanzee movie or something, or, you know, mother and dad. In other words, the human beings aren't human. And when we educate and illustrate and train and get ourselves down to that kind of point, the difference between a piece of hardware and a piece of software, a human being, is just a question of the substance it's made out of. They don't even know how to be cunning. This is a terrible thing for a preacher to say. They don't even know how to lie and deceive when they go sneaking around so they can discuss Hal's problem out of Hal's earshot. They forget that he's got this photo eye, you know, that follows them and reads their lips. You know, that's pretty bad, boy, when you forget, you know, what evil's like. It's not very human. But Hal is the human being on there. He has all the marks. If you wanted to write, you know, an anthropology, a scientific, and even a Christian vision of man, man lies, he rapes, he kills, he steals, he tries to beat the other guy, and you better be sure he's sleeping when he's sleeping, because you can't even trust him then when he sounds like he's snoring. And any vision of man that doesn't start out with that just totally ignores everything in the psychology book that we found out about man, and it ignores Genesis too. So Hal, in some way, the machine becomes a man, you know, which is never explained. It's a fairy story at that point. How does a computer learn duplicity? In what is it, you know, in aid of? What does it wish? Is it simply the basic sin to want to be God? I have decided that this mission is not important, you know. We'll make it another mission. What is it? What is it made of? Well, maybe computers, you know, have sensual sins that we can't even feel after, since we're not made out of steel and electronic components. We don't know. But he certainly seems to me, and see if you can see the movie when you go back out of here, to be the only human being in the whole thing.
Can I throw out a question?
Yeah, sure.
I've noticed in the Kubrick movies that somehow it comes across with a real feeling, a sense of sterility.
Right.
Even in Clockwork Orange, you know, it shows like a slum scene in Tenement of London, and piles of rubble, and it's clean rubble, you know, sterile garbage, if you can have such a thing. You know, and the whole thing all the way through 2001.
Absolutely clean.
Whiteness, you know,
right.
Even cleaner than hospital clean.
Yeah.
What kind of a feeling or message do you think he's trying to convey in this, or is this just cool?
Well, this point has been picked up by some of the commentators on film and brought across, and Kubrick has been asked about it, and I don't remember the exact words that he answered, and I don't think it would be important, because like most people, he gives different answers each time you ask him the same question. I mean, anybody that's any good will do you that way. Be very serious. Walt Whitman put it very succinctly a long time ago. I contradict myself. Very well, I contradict myself. I contain multitudes. That's the difference between some brainwashed robot and a human being that's really thinking. You know, his mind changes. But the sterility thing is definitely there. And it seems to be the fact that although Space Odyssey is about the so-called future of man, and Clockwork Orange is kind of, you know, a kind of a saying, be careful now, you know, playing with these toys that B.F. Skinner and Watson and everybody has put in your hands, still they are hopeless notes. They're not really hopeful. It looks as if the whole jug is lost, at least if you read the writing of his film. Now, he has one film that also gives the same message, but not in this lily-white clean way, and that's Spartacus, which is a Roman Western, really. I don't know if you saw Spartacus or not, about the slave revolt. But there, you know, you get into some of the blood and the gore and women having babies and people getting their brains knocked out and, you know, kind of really everyday human happenings. I mean, you know, that's what the world is more like than the other kind. But it's absolutely hopeless. There is never a time that Spartacus deludes himself into thinking that he can win.
Yeah,
and it's human cupidity that defeats him.
I think even in that movie, though, it's kind of where you get more of the dirt feeling from the setting.
Right.
But even in its own way, it's still got its sterility.
Well, there's a sterility in that there is no viable hope. He leads the people, and they're happy even in, you know, the midst of war for a few months because they have the hope of ultimately reaching the sea and getting away. But he knows that that hope is foundless. It's very much like Arthur Miller's plays of a few years ago, and Tennessee Williams, and Eugene O'Neill, and a number of writers from the 40s and the 50s who simply said man cannot live without illusions, and it is the duty, they seem to imply, the creative thinking person who realizes this, to provide men with illusions. They're going to die anyhow, but you should at least keep them in good spirits. There's no use telling them the truth. There is that kind of world weariness in Kubrick, definitely. I think we have to guard against that. I do not want to imply that in either one of his movies or any of these others that there's anything like the Christian Proclamation in that sense. I would say this, though, it is necessary to look through this kind of a lens before you can even say, you know, what kind of a proclamation you might be able to make.
Okay, well, like, in contrast, when David Lean could take a person and cover the person with mud,
mm-hmm.
and make it look beautiful, you know, and I think for more of David Lean's films, he's getting more of a human thing.
Mention some of the films now for people.
Well, okay, like Ryan's Daughter.
Ryan's Daughter, okay.
And in contrast to Kubrick, it gives a feeling, it's sort of a feeling of removal from the whole film. You know, a kind of interested involvement, but it's like a situation that you really aren't in. Whereas, like in David Lean's film, it's something that you can very much relate to, and it's more of a humanistic.
And yet I think Ryan's Daughter got, an R rating, didn't it? And bad reviews by the Legion of Decency and things like that. That's kind of interesting to me that these things happen. In fact, the Clockwork Orange is R too, but that's only because the particular kind of antisociality of the guy is sexual. If it had not been, I'm sure it would have probably got a PG or something like that. That's kind of interesting.
I think that in Clockwork Orange, I saw it once, and there are parts in the film that just really take you by surprise. And I think this one film is a little bit better than that, was for, you know, really grabbing you with Sweet Sweetback by Melvin Van Peebles. You know, you expected something to happen, and it didn't happen.
Didn't happen, yeah.
But something completely removed from the whole situation really clobbered you.
Mm-hmm.
But that film, I think, was just kind of a sickening film in a way. You know, but I found, you know, what it hit me.
Very. Well.
Mr. Cooper?
Yes.
I think the most interesting part about Faith Odyssey, as far as I was concerned, was when we were coming out of the movie theater and the two young men in back of us, and one said to the other, "We must have missed part of it."
That's right.
I didn't get it at all.
Yeah, I heard similar kind of comments, but we had all kinds of criticism from our students when we used it as part of a humanities course, too, you know, which really blew me away. I was thinking they would enjoy that. How much better than your average Encyclopedia Britannica film, you know? And, but yet they were really confused, and it didn't tell a straight story and all that kind of thing. And what in the hell does that ending mean, you know? Which is really kind of cool. When I was writing about that in one of the books on films, I was wondering about the ending of that thing too. And I had to put it something like this if I can find it. Yeah. The concept of what man now is and what he ought to be is a clear theme of 2001. In a basic way, the film is about the nature and destiny of man, and that's got to be of interest to Christians. And you can't ignore what anybody says about it. Although deeply involved in the description of man, the toolmaker, the story really involves the development of the human spirit and the possibility of a transcendental leap to a new stage of evolution, the more than man. At least that's what it implies, I think, in the end of the thing. Just as the ground apes were shown to have devised tools and made thereby the leap to man, the theme music of all those Sprach Zarathustra, this Nietzschean idea of the prophet coming in and telling you what you really didn't want to know, suggests that man may one day leap beyond himself to something beyond man. The question left unanswered by this film is whether this new creature represents a desirable advance over what man now is, as well as leaving unanswered the more basic question as to what the new creature is to be. In impressionistically describing what man now is or soon will be, the film, despite its fascination with technology and its accuracy scientifically, is actually anti-technological. The struggle between man and machine in the shape of HAL 3000 is dramatically portrayed. In this struggle, man overcomes machine. Man is still the better killer. He's got a much longer history of murder behind him. But it is a near thing. He's almost wiped out. The most fascinating feature of the segment of the film to me was the fact that HAL comes over as more human than the two space travelers, Bowman and Poole. HAL sins. HAL does evil. HAL lies. HAL fears death. He doesn't want to die, and he goes out with a whimper, not with a blast. By contrast, the human beings are programmed and preset to complete their mission, no matter what the cost. The ending of the movie with its psychedelic color trip through space and the arrival of the ship over Jupiter, along with that mysterious black block, which is, you know, in a way, as Kubrick seems to be saying, you want to know what God is, he's a big stone, you know, big black stone or something. It escapes rational interpretation. I think you maybe do have to be stoned to get anything out of that particular part of it. Probably Kubrick was when he made it, I'm not sure. Obviously, from the romantic music and the mythological surroundings, man is supposed to be progressing towards something beyond man, the Übermensch of Nietzsche. But exactly what is the higher man to be? There's no answer given to this, since the movie ends with a fetus-like shape, the shape of things to come, floating in space like a biological question mark. And that's how it ends, with the body of the astronaut turned in up on itself, and until it becomes almost like a zygote, or just a newly developing fetus floating in space in a question mark position. What is man going to become? And in a way, that is sterile, because, you know, there's no really any kind of clue as to which way man can proceed. He seems to be saying that technology can produce something like man, but it fits in with Clockwork Orange in a way. What does HAL really take over from man? The evil in man, along with his rationality. In fact, it is the theme of Clockwork Orange right there. But what about man in the flesh, the man who made the machine at first? What is he going to be like? Which, again, it's time for lunch, and I don't have any answer to, but it fascinates me and has through four books so far as to what is man becoming. Because there's one thing we can learn from Kubrick's films and from the rest of these kinds of things, and that is this. It isn't a question as to whether man will change. Man is changing. I think that's the thing. It's already happening. And to use the language of cybernetics or the computer, the feedback from the changes that are going on around us and how we respond to them is going to dictate what the outcome will be. Because that's part of progression, is the feedback. Yeah, the feedback that's coming from the changes that have already taken place and how we respond to them, you know, will dictate the direction that the change goes in. Because it isn't a question of just determinism. Part of history is both the deterministic elements and the feedback we receive and how we act. There's human freedom. And not to react to the feedback, but to sit back, you know, is a way of reacting, of just allowing it to go the most mechanical way. So man is, as he has always been, I dare say, throughout his existence, in doubt, in question, incomplete. But what will it be? And looking at that, maybe we've got a minute just to throw down. Every once in a while, out of trillions of words that are cast off that are no good, I get a sentence or a paragraph out that I like, that I really like, and that was one of them at the end of this book. Man is beyond else incomplete. Man's a project still under construction. He is able to make himself into a soldier bent on destruction or a medical doctor dedicated to healing. Man can change the direction his project is taking. The soldier can become a priest, a helper of the poor. The medical man can become greedy and seek to serve only the well-to-do. Man does not have freedom. God, the Christian confesses, created man as freedom. Man as free can turn his powers to destruction or construction. His essential tragedy is that in choosing to destroy himself, he destroys others and the world along with him. Man's potential glory is that in choosing to heal, to build, and to conserve his own spirit, he will heal, build, and conserve the other creatures and the earth itself. If there's one thread that runs through all the alternative lifestyles and all the questions about man today, it is this insight. Man is the potential completion of God's creation, or the instrument of God's ultimate frustration.